Thank you for downloading the Sports Hour podcast with me, Shabnam Yunus-Jewell. Coming up this week, we catch up with the Manchester City player at the top of her gaming.
At night, instead of getting a bedtime story, my dad used to play the video games and I used to sit next to him and watch it. And I remember just loving it, and that is where my love for video games started.
More from Kirsten Kasparai on the way. Love is in the air. We've got the story of how two strangers met walking the Camino de Santiago in northern Spain. 6 months later, they were married.
We were leaving a town called San Juan de Ortega, and Kiasen just walked past me, and I just saw this tall, you know, young, good-looking Danish guy. I didn't know he was Danish at the time, but he looked at me and we said, "Buen Camino, hello, how are you?" And I said, "Hi, Buen Camino."
But first this week, the Philadelphia Eagles are the first NFL team to donate sports bras as part of the complete equipment kit for their girls' flag football league to encourage and grow female participation. The league they launched in 2022 now has 52 teams with the goal to make girls' flag football an officially sanctioned sport in the state of Pennsylvania. Now, if you've never heard of it, it's basically a version of American football where the player with the ball is not tackled, but instead has to stop when another player removes a piece of cloth, the flag, that is attached to the player's waist. Now, the Eagles are working with Operation Warm to give out over 30,000 sports bras to athletes in need this year. Well, I caught up with Palumbo Lady Griffins player Ruth Dewink and her coach, Chris Donnelly.
Someone wouldn't step on the field without cleats, and a girl shouldn't step on the field without a sports bra. At our school, we're, you know, inner city Philadelphia public school. I also coach basketball, and I get a lot of girls that come to play and they've never played an organized sport before. And so equipment is something that's kind of new to them. And people would be shocked to know how many times I have to have conversations with girls about, like, do you have a sports bra? I mean, there is nothing more challenging, whatever sport you're playing, basketball, football, and you're running down the court, you're running down the field, and, you know, you're holding on to yourself as you're running. You know, if you hadn't played sports previously, you wouldn't even think about that. You know, it's saying it to the girls like, hey, you need this. And in this case for flag football, I mean, the initiative with, you know, just the Eagles doing the whole league in general is just unbelievable. I mean, I'm a lifelong Eagles fan. Ruthie's a lifelong Eagles fan. You know, I mean, that is just blows my mind a lot. And then to have them take even go invested so much more that they're recognizing like, hey, we can help these girls to have an even better experience. I mean, you know, when you have the proper equipment, all you need to worry about is getting on the field and doing your best.
I heard it being described as the gift of confidence. And I thought that is a perfect way of describing it. You know, we've all been there when we were younger, or we've had friends who've, you know, people who developed first, who've had to sit out. I've had friends in the past who've made excuses not to do PE at school. And it was because they just didn't feel confident enough. So, you know, just how important is it to have something like a sports bra for a girl's confidence?
It's very important. Like, you feel self-conscious if you don't have a sports bra on when you're running, because it's just very awkward and difficult, and you have to worry about yourself. But if you have your sports bra on, all you have to worry about is just playing your sport. Like, you're not self-conscious anymore.
Have you come across girls in the past, Chris, who have not joined the team because of issues like that, because they felt, you know, they've not had the right equipment, and you felt quite sad not to see these girls participating because of that?
I've had it after the fact, you know, like, I didn't know it kind of coming into it. But ultimately, what I then found out was like, oh, well, I didn't have the cleats, or I didn't have the this. And so I sort of felt awkward. And I was like, I wish you'd said something to me, you know, like, we would figure out. There's actually another organization called Level the Playing Field here that I believe is a national organization, but I became aware of it last year, that also is, you know, gets like gently used equipment and things like that. So like last year, we got cleats for some girls, you know, to try and go there and try and get some things that might help the girls to help it fit. Because playing sports can be expensive. You know, it really can be expensive. And especially when, if it's not something you've played your whole life, you're not going to come into high school for sure and be like, yeah, I got cleats. Or if you did, you outgrew. There are girls that, you know, as I learned, they're just not coming because. So this is great that we can get that out there to them, let them know equipment is not, like, we don't want that to be what keeps you from playing.
And Ruth, when you got into flag football, do you recall any stories like that about yourself or your friends when it came to not having enough confidence about equipment?
Oh, yeah. So when we all started last year, no one had cleats or no one had any equipment at all. So when our coach gave us all the equipment, everyone was so happy. They were more confident in our play and style because we had all that equipment that helped us advance our skills.
How much do you enjoy playing flag football?
Oh, I love it a lot. I wish I played football, but, you know, I'll probably get a concussion or something. So it's the closest thing to football, and I love football a lot.
Yeah. I've seen a video of you guys out there playing. You look like you're having a whale of a time, and it just looks so vibrant and just so much fun out there with you know, all your teammates.
I still play flag football.
Brilliant.
I'm playing in a tournament this weekend. I told these guys, I said, come on out and watch. It's all grown women from 4 or 5 different states. It is a great sport. It really and truly is.
How long have you been playing for, Chris?
Football is my favorite sport. I played tackle football for 6 years and then got smart and started playing flag football. But I've probably been playing flag football for well over 25 years.
In all that time, obviously, you know, you must have seen so many changes, but an initiative like this to give our sports bras to girls. I mean, how did that make you feel when you heard this was happening?
I think that's the interesting thing. Like, I always joke with the kids about how old I am. They don't get that element. You know, and sometimes I get like emotional, like when I'm talking to the girls about, my God, you don't even know what this opportunity is. You know, I mean, growing up, this wasn't something the girls did. You just didn't play. And I always loved football, but it was not something I could play. Girls don't do that. And so to be able to have this opportunity to have an organization like the Philadelphia Eagles, you know, and it's actually, you know, there's other teams, you know, in other states as well, other pro teams that have flag football leagues, but to have the Philadelphia Eagles, a team I grew up cheering, support this, be so bought in that not only we're just like in name, like, yeah, we're doing this league. They're like, no, we recognize that there's something that we can help you with even further to help this be a positive experience. So now we want to get sports, you know what I mean? Like that they're just 100% bought in. Like these guys don't even get it. Like they have no idea how huge this is. No idea that a grown men's tackle football organization is invested this much in girls playing a sport. Great.
Yeah. Ruth, do you girls understand the significance of an initiative like this?
Yeah, it's a big deal, especially since the Eagles is supporting us and like sponsoring us, because girls, as I said, like they're overlooked in sports and stuff. And having the Eagles, especially, well, since we grew up with them, and men support us, is a big deal because everyone loves football. And when the Eagles are supporting us, they're going to like come over to us and like support us too. So that's great.
Do you know about any of the girls who've received any of the bras and yourself? I mean, how have they been received so far?
Some of us, we probably just got the wrong size, but it's definitely giving us confidence and it's enhancing our skills. So yes, it's great.
So the girls are enjoying having them, even though you're sort of swapping around sizes and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
But it's good to have them.
Yeah.
But even that, you know, the fact that like size wise, I mean, I think, you know, the girls didn't understand, like so many of them are not used to it, you know? And so it's like, when you say what size, well, I'm not sure what size. And so a couple of the girls were doing some swapping and things like that. It's a work in progress. We'll get it down for next season.
Yeah, brilliant initiative there. That was Palumbo Lady Griffins player Ruth Dewink and her coach Chris Donnelly. Well, now, Sports Hour listeners, this is the part where we relax and get ready for a fairy tale story of serendipity straight out of a movie. American ex-teacher who feels at a crossroads in life decides to grab a backpack and go on the adventure of a lifetime. She goes all the way to Spain to hike the famous 500-mile Camino del Santiago, where she meets a fellow walker, a Danish medical student who is on his own path. But their journeys combine and they end up falling in love. And when they reach their destination in Santiago, they get engaged. 10 years later, Lonnie and Kjartan Bergqvist are married with children living in Denmark. What a story. Of course, we wanted to get the details, so I asked Lonnie herself.
I was 29 at the time, and I was in, I guess you would consider, a little bit of a midlife crisis, quarter life crisis. I was single, I was living out in California, but I was also just very much questioning whether I should continue down my career path, whether I should change careers, you know, what should I do with my life? I was coping in honestly some pretty destructive ways. I was drinking a lot. I was going out a lot. I was, you know, dating a lot of different people, really just trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I woke up in the middle of the night and honestly, it just kind of popped in, this idea of walking the Camino. And I had heard about it many, many years ago from my uncle, but honestly, it was a middle of the night decision that I just thought, why should I not do this? I need something to disrupt my life. I need something to break all of these habits that I just kept, you know, using in order to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I booked actually a plane ticket that night. So I wouldn't leave for a few months later, but took the decision, booked the plane ticket, and yeah, the rest was history.
Tell me when you first, that moment when you first saw Kjartan and how that meeting went.
We were leaving a town called San Juan de Ortega, and there was a thunderstorm in the distance. And I had lived in California for about 10 years, so I was really excited to see some rain. And Kjartan just walked past me, and I just saw this tall, you know, young, good-looking Danish guy. I didn't know he was Danish at the time, but he looked at me and we said, Buen Camino. Hello, how are you? And I said, hi, Buen Camino. We exchanged just some really like simple small talk about the weather. I mean, it was nothing profound, but I do remember when he walked away, this dreamer, this romantic in me, I said to myself, you know, I could live in Denmark. I could live in Copenhagen.
What?
Yeah.
You said that straight away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like some kind of lightning hit then before you saw the thunderstorm.
Yeah, I mean, to be really fair, I mean, I'm a dreamer. And actually, a lot of people that I meet, you know, I start to kind of like, ooh, what could that look like? And what could our life look like together? That's just how I am. So like in that moment, I mean, yeah, I was really open to Copenhagen. And I didn't know anything about Denmark. I had seen the old Danny Kaye movie, Hans Christian Andersen, you know, when I was little. That's the only thing I knew about Denmark and Copenhagen. But you know, it sounded like a great, great idea, a great adventure at the time.
Wow. So what happened next then? Did you bump into each other again? How did you, you know, actually connect?
All along the Camino, there are these albergues where the pilgrims stay. And in the evening time, there's usually a cafe or a pub nearby. And, you know, people are gathering, drinking, eating, whatever. And I was with a group there. I didn't recognize Kjartan again, even though I bumped into him in the street. It was just kind of a normal, you know, pilgrim meeting. But that night we were at a table and he overheard me say to someone else that I was taking a rest day. And to be fair, I don't remember talking to him, but I also might have been a little tipsy. So, but he remembers talking to me and he also remembers that I was going to take a rest day. So he decided that he would actually stay in this town called Burgos the next day and try to catch me so that we could talk some more. He ran downstairs in the morning and asked if I wanted to have a cup of coffee. And then we sat at a cafe and really talked for the first time.
Wow. So it was over coffee that you sort of established that connection.
Yeah.
I mean, so that coffee was that the key moment, you would say?
The Camino is a really spooky place. I mean, if you really go into Camino as metaphor and that this long hike is like a metaphor for life, you know, every little thing that happens, you're kind of looking for what is the meaning in this. And actually the moment that was most terrifying and wonderful about our meeting was over coffee. But it was when I asked Kjartan the question, what do you want to leave behind? The day before in San Juan de Ortega, I had actually decided like definitively that I wanted to have children. Like this was a huge moment for me because I didn't know if that's what I wanted. And when I asked Kjartan this question over coffee, he said, a family. The only thing I want to leave behind is a family. That's the only thing I want out of life.
Wow. So after that, I suppose, because you were spending quite a lot of time together on the hike, which doesn't normally happen in real life, I suppose. You don't get to spend all that time with somebody intensely. And I suppose, did you realize quite soon that he could be the one and vice versa?
It took me a while, to be honest. I mean, I knew we had a connection, but I was very resistant because I didn't come to the Camino to meet anybody. I came, you know, to carve out this space in my own life and figure out who I was and what I wanted. And I really came to pilgrimage with an openness towards that kind of transformation. So for me, I thought, okay, this is a fling. Like, do I really want to go back to California and say I spent, you know, the whole time on the Camino, like just playing around with the Danish guy? And so I was really fighting it for a long time. So it was maybe about 5 days in after we met that I really started to surrender a bit more to the idea that we could actually be something together. But it was maybe I was more in the way of it in the beginning because I was just very scared, I think, of what it could mean if it was something.
Yeah. So he was more open than you were.
Yeah. You know, I think he also for him, I mean, he was very restless. He came to the Camino with a similar kind of spirit of like really wanting to shake up his life. But also I think, you know, he really wanted an adventure and a good time. And so I don't think he was quite as scared of the same things that I was. He's also quite a bit younger than me. He's 6 years younger. So he wasn't really at that critical like threshold of being 29 and trying to figure out life at the time.
And when you, like you say, you surrendered, can you remember thinking like the moment where you thought, I think I might be falling in love here?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
We actually walked with another pilgrim from Canada. Her name was Liz, and she became kind of the third person like in our little group, which was fantastic because she was a bit of a buffer for us, but also like just a wonderful person. And we had stumbled on this. It was an albergue, a cafe, but it was just like in the middle of nowhere. There was chickens running around. There was donkeys. There were hammocks. And we had intended just to stay for a very short time, like a cup of coffee. And then, you know, we ended up staying the whole day and slept there because we were just having such a good time together. And I remember being in this hammock and kind of looking up at Kiasen. He was like sitting next to me. But I had a bit of a panic around, like, I think I'm actually falling for this person. Like, but you say it out loud and you say, I've only known this person 5 days. How is this possible to love someone or to really feel this deeply about someone? So, but I think at that point I was able to surrender to it because it was really powerful. And, and honestly, I really started to fall for him.
Wow. So by the time you got to the end, there was obviously a very deep connection between the two of you, and you've told us before that Kartan is actually a little bit shy, which is why he's not on here. You're talking to us, but he obviously at the time knew what he wanted. He didn't want to let you go, so he proposed.
Yeah.
So I mean, like, tell us about that moment, leading up to that moment, and when it happened. Did you expect it or not?
We had talked like very briefly about marriage in the theoretical sense. And I think both of us planted a bit of an idea, like, could this be something that would happen to us? But it was still like just so out of reality. Like, there's no way you could, you know, get married to someone or get engaged to someone after such a short time. But when we got to Santiago, we spent the next day just, you know, getting clean clothes. And I think I bought some makeup or something, like just, you know, just something nice and special. And then we went out with Liz that night. And as we were talking through the next steps, talking through the future, Kiasen said to me, I don't want to go home without you. You know, and I was just, yeah, me too. Yeah, I don't want to go home either. And then he said, no, I don't want to go home without you in my life. And I thought, yeah, me too. Like, of course. And then he looked at me and he said, so it's settled then. And I was like, what is settled? You know? And he's like, well, do I need to say the words? And I thought, yes, like there's a huge language issue, communication issue. And he said, well, Lonnie, will you marry me? And I just kind of looked at him and I said, yes, I will. Why not? I don't know. It wasn't a shock, even though I know, like, to people that don't know the Camino or know how intense a hike like that can be. But I think everybody that I've talked to that has done some kind of pilgrimage or some kind of experience like this and has met someone, it's not a surprise because of how close you can grow over that period of time.
Lonnie Bergqvist there, who was trying to find herself 10 years ago, but found love instead, speaking to us from a home in Denmark now. Great story. We all love a good love story, don't we? On a morning. Well, next on Sports Hour, the sounds of celebration in Kathmandu. They're used to welcoming back those who have conquered Everest in the Nepalese capital. 800 do it every year. But earlier this week, Hari Budhamagar achieved a notable and remarkable first. Hari, a former soldier with the Gurkha Regiment, lost both legs while serving in the British Army in Afghanistan after becoming the first double above-the-knee amputee to reach the summit of the world's highest mountain. He sent this message to the world from the windy slopes of base camp.
Yes, we did it. How did I felt standing on top of the world? It was amazing. It was a snowstorm, so couldn't stay longer. Have a nice view. We took a few pictures our worry was to how to get safe down. We were running out of oxygen how far we can go down. So that was our worry, but I absolutely felt amazing and we created a history. I and my team were very proud of that. So what's my next plan? I'm just thinking to promote peace. I escaped the war in Nepal and went to fight another war. So war doesn't help anyone. And there is only sufferers. So definitely I'm looking to promote peace. And the climate change, if you see, it's around here. About 2 meters, ice has been melted since we came here. So we just need to protect the planet for our future generations. So my lifetime goal is to changing the perception on persons with disability. My life was changed in a blink of an eye. So anyone's life can change. We can be a wrong place at the wrong time and our life will be never be the same again. But whatever happens, we can still live the fulfilling life. To do that, we need to change the perception. We need to make awareness of our disability. But also, who would like to achieve something in the life, who has a dream, then whatever the situation you are in, you can achieve any dreams that we have in life. We just need to adapt according to the time and situation. If a double above knee amputee can climb the Everest, you can climb whatever mountain that you have. As long as you are disciplined, work hard, and put everything into it. One step at a time, we can climb the Mount Everest.
The remarkable Hari Budhamagar. When Hari has recovered from the expedition, he's promised to join us on Sports Hub. Now, I've been talking to one of Manchester City's players, but not about matters on the pitch. Dutch defender Kerstin Kasperi is an avid gamer, and she's been telling me all about her big hobby.
I think my love of gaming started when I was younger. We had a PlayStation 1, so it's like when I was early 2000s, and we had a Lara Croft Tomb Raider game, and obviously I was young, so I couldn't play it myself, and I was a bit scared as well. So at night, instead of getting a bedtime story, my dad used to play the video games, and I used to sit next to him and watch it, and I remember just loving it. And as I was growing older, I was able to play myself, and I think that is where my love for video games started.
Well, I do remember that Lara Croft game, and I did play it, so yes. We won't mention how there's a difference in age between us, but I think the difference with me is that, you know, I played computer games as a child with my siblings, but I don't really play them anymore. So how is it that your love of gaming has continued? How have you stayed in love with it?
It has developed so much since, you know, me being a kid to me now being a young adult. And I think especially with like online gaming, you can now chat to your friends, speak to your friends, game with them while they might be in other countries or other side of the world even. So I think that's something that makes you feel connected to people. And I think that is actually really fun. And overall, it just helps me relax when I get home from a long day of training.
Yeah. So what are your favorite games? And does FIFA feature highly in those?
FIFA doesn't feature as highly as I'd like. I actually got battered years ago when I've got a younger brother. He's 7 years younger than I was. I think he was around 12 years old, and I'm 7 years older, so do the math. And I got absolutely battered. I think it was 5-0 down at halftime, and I rage quit it And from then on, I didn't really play FIFA anymore. So it's kind of a sore spot for me. I'm very much into like action games, open world games. I play on different devices. So I've got a VR device as well. I love playing golf on that. I actually get sore in my arm. So sometimes when I come into training, it's like, oh, I'm so sore. It's like, we didn't do any gym. Like, no, I was on my VR last night.
Yeah. So obviously it's a great thing to do and it helps you relax in your downtime. And I mean, you often see male footballers, it seems like they do nothing but gaming in their spare time. Whenever you see, you know, a football team on television or just in general, is it the same kind of culture among female footballers or not?
No, I think as well as here at the club, as with national team, I'm one of the few girls that actively games. So no, I don't think we've got a big gaming culture in women's football, which to be fair, I don't really mind. I think we as women, you know, with our position, you know, compared to the men's game, we do have a lot more next to it, like jobs or studies. And I think that is really good in a sense. But I mean, obviously love some mates to game with.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think if more women sort of got together and played, it helps you in your job as a footballer? You know, playing football games, does that help you get any skills as a footballer?
Obviously, you can't do, you know, the Echo 3000 from playing FIFA. But I do think it helps you in your development. I think it did for me, just like with some insights in the game. You know, I was trying to play, you know, FIFA goals, as I mentioned before. Pass it into the goal basically and try and have all the players touch the ball once. And I think that really develops the way you look at the game. So I do think it can be helpful at times.
So you said it's not that important for women to play more computer games, but I mean, do you think they should for certain reasons, like maybe relaxation and all that kind of thing? Because you know, you'd recommend it.
I mean, I would always recommend it. It's mostly just what people like and if people enjoy it. Some people, you know, like to do gaming. Some like to go for a long walk. So if it fits for you, if you want to, you know, see how it goes or if it's something for you, then I would definitely recommend doing it as long as you're passionate about it. Yeah.
How do you think you get girls more involved in it?
Make sure it's available as well. For me, how I have always felt it, there's nothing holding me back from playing video games. Maybe other than that, it can be quite expensive. But you sometimes just have to fight probably with your older brothers or younger brothers, as I did, for who gets more playing time. But if you want to do it, then again, I would just try it.
Yeah, absolutely. I had younger brothers. There's four sisters and two brothers, so we didn't have to fight them so much. But we used to have some good tournaments when we were younger.
Oh, yeah, that's great as well.
Absolutely. And just before I let you go, Kirsten, you've got a big game, final game of the season, and you could still qualify for Europe, but it's not in your hands. So how important is it for you guys as a team to end the season on a high against Everton?
I think it's really important. The last 2 weeks have been a little bit disappointing, but I think if we end on a high and if we do everything we can, we'll see how it is after the final whistle. And at least we know we've gave it everything and it's out of our hands, as you mentioned.
Manchester City's Dutch defender, Kirsten Casperi. Now, for me, nothing comes close to the 1985 World Snooker Championship final for pure sporting drama. My producer, Craig, agrees. Massive snooker fan. I can see him smiling now. On one side, we had the defending champion, Steve Davis. On the other, an Irishman with funny upside-down glasses, Dennis Taylor, who had never won the biggest prize in the sport. It went to the final black of the final frame with over 18 million people here in the UK watching after midnight, a record for British television.
He's done it. Dennis Taylor, for the first time, becomes Embassy World Snooker Champion 1985.
I caught up with Dennis to talk about the most famous final in the sport's history for the Framed Snooker podcast. That remarkable night made him a recognisable figure all around the world and led to many adventures, including a memorable trip to India for a TV show called The Real Marigold Hotel.
It was very, very busy from morning to night. You were recording. But the highlight for me when they took me to Uttamundi, which is a hill station with a population of about 75,000 people up in the mountains where the British Army used to convalesce. And they brought me to the Uti Club, that's still a very exclusive club. And there's the room where they invented the game of snooker and wrote the rules. And the room is just as it was back in 1875. And Paul Nicholas and me went into the room and I had a game with the secretary. And then Paul had to set the final black up and borrowed my glasses, but he couldn't see a thing through my glasses. We had to move the black right over the pocket. But when he potted, he did a better impersonation of me when I beat Steve Davis. So that was the highlight of the whole 4 weeks we were there, to get to the club where the game of snooker was invented by an army officer called Neville Chamberlain. So that was brilliant, that was.
I also remember the fact that you got recognised by people in India.
Well, I'd been to India many years before that, but you see, the social media, we went to another club. It was a very poor area we went to, and the tables, you could see the slate coming through where the cloth was torn and that. And I thought, well, nobody's going to know me in this club. But sure enough, they've all... and even we had the tuk-tuks. We used to have a tuk-tuk, and he was only 22, the driver, a lovely lad. Used to, if we had to go somewhere, he would take me around. And then he sort of went on social media and seen the final, and I got in the tuk-tuk the next morning, and he's done an impersonation of Ted Lowe. He's gone, oh, dear, you know, when I missed the black.
What are the real highlights of everything that you've done?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say going to India and going to the Uti Club where the game was invented, because I watched snooker in black and white back in the 60s. They used to show it on Grandstand, Joe Davis and the Brothers Stowe. So to be able to become a professional snooker player and to be able to go around the world, and some of the people that I have met, I've been so lucky through snooker, which got you into golf. And then you used to meet some of the people I have met. I mean, we used to play, I think it was 27 years I played, along with Willie Thorne, the Howard Keel Golf Classic. Now, he used to bring people over. I used to love watching Johnny Mathis sing when I was young. And I'm sitting in a buggy playing golf with Johnny Mathis. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. I remember meeting Jack Lemmon. And meeting all these people through snooker. The first time when the Masters was played at the New London Theatre in the early days before it went to Wembley, who's sitting in the audience? Jimmy Tarbuck. I mean, Jimmy was the fifth Beatle at the time, and there's Jimmy Tarbuck. I got to meet Jimmy Tarbuck. So, yeah, very, very lucky to have met some wonderful people just through snooker. So I've been very, very, very blessed, really, very lucky.
And can I ask you a bit about the sort of state of the game at the moment and what you think of it? Obviously, you've been around for a long time. How do you think snooker has evolved?
I think it's fantastic, the standard that they're playing to these days. It used to be back in the day, you'd say the top eight players, and you know, then outside that, the standard wasn't brilliant. But nowadays, from all over the world as well, and I think the fact that the Chinese players are coming through and they've based themselves in Sheffield, you've got to admire them to leave home and come over here. But it's fabulous to see that. I mean, I remember playing in Germany many, many years ago, but it's for expats. Now they're going there with tournaments with 2,500 people turning up to watch them. And it was great to see them back in Hong Kong, because we used to go there. And then Ronnie playing, was it Marco Fu? 9,000 people turned up to watch a snooker match. Yeah. So in those early days, with people like Ray Reardon and John Spencer, and along with Ted Lowe, we used to go around the world, but we were promoting the game everywhere we went. You know, we put a lot of work into helping the game to grow. And it's great to see how popular it is around the world.
That was snooker icon Dennis Taylor. And this was the Sports Hour podcast with me, Shabnam Yunus-Jewell. If you like this edition of the podcast, please leave a rating and a comment. We would like to hear from you.